This is Marion Callahan reporting with Gannett News from the suburbs of Philadelphia, or more specifically, my home office here in Doylestown. And today I am grateful to introduce to our listeners and viewers Dr. Harris Cohen, partner in a Hatboro family practice, but also who has carved another role for himself during this pandemic as a local blogger and a host of a regular Facebook Live meeting that brings more than just expertise, medical expertise, to the Philadelphia region. Dr. Cohen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And first, if we could talk about why you began blogging, about your experience, and judging from the responses of your Facebook Live talks, you bring a lot of calm, humor, and also some perspective to this craziness that I know we are all experiencing in different ways. But as you mentioned to me, this came out of a period of frustration. So could you tell me a little bit about how this all came about?
Yeah, sure. I am not a frequent Facebook poster, but I was in the office on a Saturday morning in March, just as the virus was starting to take hold in the country, where there's a lot of unsurety. We weren't sure what to do. And I was 10, 15 patients in when I realized I am not offering the amount and quality of care that I'm used to offering, because I don't know where to send people for testing. People are very scared. People did not, the information at that point was very bleak and very sparse. And most of my visits that day and phone calls that day were, doctor, I have a fever. Doctor, I just flew from Taiwan. Doctor, my Aunt Sally looks a little bit ashen. What can I do to make sure I don't have this virus? And back and forth with the Department of Health in Pennsylvania, my office staff and me, we just couldn't figure out where to get people tested. So I really felt flummoxed by this. And at the end of the morning, I just sat down at Facebook. I didn't know what to do. It was probably therapeutic for me. And I put a post out that says, I need help. I don't know where to send people for testing. We're scared. I'm scared. My staff is scared. What can I do? It was more probably more introspective than it was looking for real answers. But it got a lot of feedback that day. That was a Saturday morning. So that's where it all began.
And so what kind of feedback were you getting early on? I mean, I know that there was a lot of information out there and a lot of misinformation out there. So what kind of myths did you have to dispel? Or tell me a little bit about the reaction and what you had to let people know to calm them.
Yeah, so from that initial post, I received a lot of feedback from doctor friends, medical friends, regular friends. I don't know where to go. What do you do? Some doctors offered some places where I could send people that weren't realistic, because you had to be in network at a certain hospital system to send your patients there. So the feedback that I initially got was more, hey, we know where you're coming from, but there wasn't a real solution to it. So that very next day, Sunday, I was home. And I sat down on my computer again, and I wrote a Q&A to try and answer what, and there were my own questions and my own answers. It wasn't crowdsourced at all like they are now. And my goal was to answer questions that I could answer at that time, because there was so much confusion among medical people, non-medical people, my friends, my family members. So I put together a very brief 8 to 9 question Q&A. Which really took off like wildfire. I think I got about 1,600 shares on Facebook, which is, I think my record was 1. So it beat that handily. So it really struck a tone and resonated with people that they're craving information. And as a medical provider, as a family doctor, I felt like I would be a good source for them. So that's where this sort of all began. I'm not sure if that answered your initial question. I spun off on a tangent like I usually do.
But like, give me some examples, if you could. I like the fact that you weren't sugarcoating anything, you know, and at that time of uncertainty, you were direct. And I think we all craved that. So give me a couple of examples of some advice you gave them that was direct and in your way.
Yeah. So, you know, basically it was all centered around what should I be doing and what shouldn't I be doing. At that time, social distancing was a new word. Flattening the curve was a new phrase. This is not something we're taught in medical school. I'm not an epidemiologist. For non-medical people, it's overwhelming to deal with these words and phrases. So I wanted to sort of say, look, you know, I want to go visit my mother. Should I? No. I want to go to the mall. Should I? No. I want to go for a walk. Should I wear a mask? No. And at the time, the guidance was different than it is now. I look back at my initial post and, you know, should I wear a mask in public? And the answer was no. And the reason why was we had a massive shortage of masks for medical people. So they didn't want the public mm-hmm. grabbing all the masks. And obviously the guidance has changed since then, like it has on many things. But in a tongue-in-cheek way, I tried to create scenarios that said, stay at home, just please. And that was the moral of the story, but I tried to inject a little humor and poke a little fun at some stores and some people out there to say, look, just please, just stay at home. When in doubt, the answer is stay at home.
I love it. Stay at home, you ignorant fools.
Exactly. Stay at home, please. I don't care what permutation. I don't care if you're visiting your aunt in California who's in a wheelchair and has 1 month to live. The answer is still the same. Stay at home, please.
I know. I liked, again, like I said, I liked how direct you were. And I think at that time, humor and directness and just a clarity and some information from someone in the medical profession was most definitely appreciated. And so, like, based on your expertise and what you were hearing from your colleagues, other medical professionals across the country, what were some myths early on or even now that you continue to dispel about the virus?
Yeah, there's still plenty of myths. I think the initial myth, there's an email going around that gained a lot of traction, basically saying, you know, the 10 things you could do to prevent coronavirus. One is gargling with hot water, or drinking tea, or gargling with Listerine, or inhaling for 10 seconds. And if you can hold your breath for 10 seconds, you don't have the virus.
That doesn't work?
You know what? I don't think so. I've been drinking lots of hot water. I've been good so far, but yeah, you know, people were grasping for something that made them feel safe. So I understand why these things gain traction. But at the same time, a lot of my friends at local hospitals, whether they were emergency room doctors or intensivists or nurses, they were painting a very bleak picture of what was really going on. And this was a time where we weren't sure if we had enough ventilators for people who might need them. The sickness and the acuity of sickness far exceeded what we were thinking. This flattening the curve phrase was entering our lexicon for the first time, and explaining that to people was somewhat difficult. So the myths of prevention and the myths of things you could do to prevent it did not match up with the true way to prevent transmission of COVID-19 coronavirus.
And were there any stories that you heard, whether it's in the medical community or maybe in your own community where you live, that really resonated with you, whether it was something that made the reality of this situation sink in or that helped put things in perspective for you so you could then put them in perspective for others?
Yeah, there are two sources of information that I would sort of go through on a daily basis. One was checking in with my true friends on the front lines. These are people in the hospital. I'm out on the front lines. I am very much on the back lines right now, trying to do my best. But these are people who were in the heat of battle. So trying to decipher what they were seeing and sort of curating that information in a way that wasn't as fearful. They're a member of a couple Facebook groups that have hundreds of thousands of physicians, where each day they were trying to sift through the data. As a novel virus, this information is crowdsourced. I mean, we have no data. The Chinese data, unfortunately, has to be taken with a grain of salt. We're not sure how accurate it is. So really, it's Facebook postings, crowdsourcing with people much smarter than I, trying to figure out what treatments work, what treatments don't work. Do we put them on a ventilator? Do we not put them on a ventilator? So that was sort of the bleak end of things I had to sift through, and then sort of try to couple that with some of the positives that we were seeing. And there are and were plenty of positives. I mean, my friend who works in the emergency room who came outside to his driveway to chalk that said, thank you for being a hero. I mean, man, goosebumps everywhere. How great a story is that? And I wanted to share some of the good coupled with all the medical horribleness that was going on. It's not even a word, I don't think, but all the horrific stories that I was hearing from the front lines.
And what are you hearing from the front lines now?
The front lines have changed. I think as we are getting a better grasp on this disease, we're getting ahead of it a little bit. We were way behind because we've never seen it before. We're getting a better idea of how this disease works, what organ systems are affected. We're getting a better idea of the fact that we do not have to ventilate everybody who is sick. People do very well at low oxygen levels. It's called happy hypoxia, which we've never seen before. Just by putting someone on their belly for 18 hours a day, it's called proning, people do just as well sometimes, and again, this is a case-by-case scenario, than being on a ventilator, which causes its own mental and physical negatives to the human body. So we've really transitioned from this being a respiratory disease only and everybody going on a ventilator and praying they come off of it to really a disease that affects multiple organ systems and multiple parts of our immune system, and trying to figure out ways to pre-treat and treat in ways that prevent harsh treatments. You know, first do no harm. We don't want the cure to be worse than the disease, and we're getting there. So ventilator use, I think, has peaked based on all of our numbers. The need for ventilators is not what we thought it was, which is a wonderful blessing. But we are, again, every day brings new information on how to treat the very sick and also how to maybe talk about preventive measures in a better way. So the evolution of this is almost daily at this point. So what I'm telling you right now, it might be wrong tomorrow. So you got to take everything, again, with a grain of salt, because this is a novel virus. We have to remember that.
And, you know, I guess based on your last blog, I saw that you mentioned that you yourself went out to test for antibodies. Tell me a little bit about what drove you to that and what you're hoping will come from that.
Yeah, antibody testing is more a curiosity right now than something that we can effectively use day to day. So the theory behind antibodies is that if you had disease or if you were asymptomatic or had light disease, your body will create antibodies after a certain amount of time. These antibodies will be present in your blood for hopefully a long amount of time. So the questions are, A, how long are the antibodies there? B, does antibody presence actually equal immunity? And if it does, for how long? And C, how accurate are these tests? You know, if your antibodies are positive, do you have some level of immunity or not? So this is where we are now. So in an effort to get back to normal living, academically, I'm thinking, man, I'm going to have tons of exposure. I'm a doctor. I was working with patients well before this was actually known to be out there. I think it was in our country probably January, February, and March. I'm always with sick people. I'm doing all that I can, but I'm wearing a button-down shirt, and I'm wearing khakis, and I'm cleaning my stethoscope as much as possible, and I'm washing my hands 800 times a day. Was that enough? And I see sick patients all the time, and we try to take the appropriate preventive measures. So I wanted to step up and check my antibody, see if I'm positive or negative, not because it's going to change my behavior, but more out of curiosity. And then I want to offer it to my office as well, the entire staff, to see whether they have antibodies as well. Surprisingly or unsurprisingly, I do not have antibodies. I am IgG negative. I'm not shocked. I'm a little surprised. But I want to be able to offer this test to patients who are curious, go through the pros and cons of what this test means. And if I come back positive or negative, I'm not going to change the way I'm going to deal with being with a patient. I'm still going to take super, super precautions. But I was a little surprised. And, you know, I think we need way more data. We need way more tests. We need to verify the accuracy of the testing as well as what does a positive test mean. And we're not there yet. So right now it's more of an academic curiosity. But the more numbers we get, the more people that get tested, the more we can interpret what the meaning of the tests are.
Right. And like you mentioned, I mean, there's so much data out there, and what's recommended one day, you know, changes the next day. But it has been comforting to have somebody in the local community. I mean, you're not just working. I mean, you're still working right now. You're doing telemedicine, but you're also offering, you know, this informative, really public service to the community. So I want to ask you, what are some responses, specific responses? I don't know if you could share any of them with us that you've heard, not necessarily from friends or colleagues, but from strangers who you've reached, you know, through this this dialogue that you've created.
Yeah, the amazing thing about social media is really the exposure you have that starts very granular with friends and family, and then they can share, they can send it to their friends. So it becomes this exponential growth. So there's plenty of people who I'm now reaching, both through my Facebook lives on Tuesday nights and through my blogging twice a week. I don't know who they are, and I'm just trying to provide some measure of hope. So I think you're right. I think it's more important, you know, when you hear from a loved one, they love you. They're going to tell you you're doing great no matter what. But to hear from complete strangers that I'm the only news source they trust, you know, that carries a lot of, you know, it gives me a nice warm fuzzy feeling, but it also gives me a feeling of, man, I better be giving out the right information. I don't want to mislead anybody. That if I provide a measure of calm, that people get to laugh out loud and spit their coffee on their computer screens. Yeah. And that's really important right now, because we have to remember we're all in this together. We all want the same thing. We all want to get back to some semblance of normalcy. So my role in my blood as a doctor is to provide medical information, but in my role as a human, my way has always been with humor, and in trying to, you know, I don't want to create a false sense of calm, but I want people to understand the data in a way that makes sense for them. And I want to break it down into very simplistic tones. So the feedback is 99% wonderful. We live in political times. 1% of people I might rub the wrong way, and that's okay. That's, you know, I'm not here to please, I'm here to educate. And typically that 1% is a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend who disagrees with what I've said. And that's okay. You know, that's fine. I think we have to have respectful discourse, and that's what social media opens up. Unfortunately, there's a lot of unrespectful or disrespectful discourse as well. So, you know, for me, just to hear that I'm providing calm in a period of hysteria, or if I'm providing humor in a period of time where people are crying a lot and feel lonely and isolated, that really means a ton to me. And I'm not doing it for those compliments, because this is really therapeutic for me as well. But to hear that's really reassuring as a doctor and as a human being.
Right. And also, as a dad, I remember seeing, I think it was one of your first Facebook Lives, and you had your son there with you. And I know, just as a mom of three, being new to this Zoom technology, I've needed some advice and some consulting from my 14-year-old. So tell me a little bit about how you've adjusted to the new normal, and how your kids and how your family is adjusting as well and supporting you.
Yeah, we're in very unique times now. I'm used to being at work. I'm used to seeing patients live. I'm used to giving patients a hug before they go and using my stethoscope. We're not doing that right now. We're doing complete telemedicine, which is video, ideally audio sometimes, and trying to rev that up so we can provide a presence for our patients before we reopen physically. With that, as you know, comes complications. So I have two doors behind me right now, which may open at any time with someone saying, I want lunch. And that's just a part of the way life is. I don't have a pet that runs in to make fun, but, you know, getting the family involved has been great with the Facebook Lives. My son initially was helping me field the questions online. He found that Fortnite was more important for him. So I hired my 11-year-old daughter, and she's been doing a great job, and she's become a little celebrity.
She invites, gets TikTok in her way, and then maybe she'll
She absolutely is multitasking, and you must have been here, because she is TikToking, you know, while she's giving me questions. But, you know, again, this is a very organic, I'm doing it from my home office. I don't have fancy lights and makeup and airbrushing, and this is what you get, for better or for worse. But, you know, it's tough, because families, you know, during the day when I'm doing televisits, they don't necessarily see me working, you know, because I'm sitting in my office and I'm talking to patients on a screen. So boundaries are not always respected, and that's okay. You know, and in patients, I see dogs running behind. I see people, you know, belching and passing wind on camera. Look, people are human. There's funny things that happen. They're eating, they're drinking, they're spilling, they have stains on their shirt. But and you look wonderful. It's a new reality, and I think it provides much needed levity to a very, very tough situation. So, you know, and all families are going through this. People are working from home now, and interruptions are bound to happen.
And you're right. With all of this anxiety, we need to laugh and we need to smile. And you mentioned the other day getting in your car and going out for a drive, and just how strange that felt, you know, so abnormal. So talk to me about some of the things that you've experienced and that you've seen that make you smile and that make you think, well, you know, I'm going to reflect on this later in my musings.
Yeah, it's, you know, I keep notes during the week on things that I see either in the news or from friends or on their Facebook posts. So, you know, there's this normal is very abnormal. So taking simple things for granted, like you mentioned, my family of four, we've not been in the car together since March. Normally we're in the car together 8 times a day with between 35 practices and school and instruments and religious school, blah, blah, blah. So to be together and actually take a step back and say, well, I appreciate this now. We bought a pickleball set, and we have chalk in our driveway, and we've played, we're learning the rules as we go. We're playing pickleball as a family. We go
for walks. Yes, that's every great. Day.
There's so much good that's come from this. You know, I'm home. I, you know, for better or for worse, I'm with my kids a lot. We have a family TV show we watch every night. I get to put them to sleep every night. We get to have every single meal together, which is wonderful and also a challenge, because, you know, how much macaroni and cheese can you have? But, you know, you got to pinch yourself every once in a while and say, you know what? We are being locked down, but we're locked down at home. We're not on a battlefield. We're not in prison. We're not in a cage. We're restricted, but restricted with our families. I really feel for people who are alone and are isolated and are living by themselves. It's a major challenge. And I've talked in the blogs about, look at the technology we have now. I mean, if I lived alone, you lived alone, we can still talk every day. And in talking to you over the past couple of weeks, we're having Zoom conversations with friends from college and friends from high school and people we normally wouldn't talk to. So I think a lot of relationships have been strengthened both from immediate family and people you normally wouldn't chat with. And how cool is that?
So true. Yeah, that's so many very good things have come out of this. But what are some things that you still find concerning and that you still find worrisome? I mean, I'm not trying to look for reasons to fear, but what are some things that we need to be aware of and just keep in mind so we don't get complacent?
Yeah, we've done a great job. Most of the country has done a great job when they're looking at cellular phone data and seeing if people are truly shutting down. They are, and we live in Montgomery and Bucks County, and we've done a good job. But because we've done a good job, we have flattened the curve. We have reduced the surge on the hospital system. We've reduced the need for the very sick to not be able to get medical care. But we can't do this forever. We cannot socially distance forever. So we need very, very slow, graduated rollout based on where this disease is. So Montana is very different than New York City. Montana is going to be able to roll out a lot quicker because 8 people live every 37 square miles. That's a number I made up. It might be incorrect. But New York City, Philadelphia, Kirkland and Seattle, Florida, we're clustered together. So we can't just open things up right away. We all want to get out there. No one wants to be closed off. You know, I live close to Philadelphia. We're going to be one of the last counties to open up. I get it. And there's financial and physical and mental stress that goes along with this social isolation and being shut down, not being able to earn money. But we really have to do this slowly because all the data shows surge after inappropriate rollout. We saw it in China. We saw it in Hong Kong. We're going to see it in Georgia. We've seen it in Florida. Every time you open a beach, you can go to the beach. Just don't walk next to strangers on the beach. You know, there's going to be these peaks and peaks and peaks till we get back to some semblance of reality with vaccine or widespread herd immunity. But please listen to those who know more than all of us do. Listen to the governors who are relying on regional data. We all want to get out. We all do. We all want the same thing, but let's get there in a rational manner or else we're going to be right back to where we were now. It doesn't work to do it all or nothing. It can't work that way.
And, you know, it's interesting, as you mentioned, the transition, you know, to, I don't even know whether I should even use the word normalcy, but in transitioning, what do you think are some like social nuances, some interactions that will likely change, maybe some things that you're seeing in other countries that could serve as guidance for us now, you know, as we're trying to find a new way of civility instead of shaking hands and hugging. Example, instead of saying thank you, I hear some people are clapping or nodding. What are some little things that we may see just to somewhat replace those human touches that we won't be able to experience physically?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the era of the handshake and the high five are going to be on hold for a little while, hugging strangers. I think we're going to change some of our social cues. I think there's going to be, like you mentioned, clapping when you agree with something or a quick wave or an air hug. You know, there's ways to sort of show, you know, meaning without touch. You know, I'm not sure the elbow bang is going to make sense. I was doing that before we physically closed the office. I'm not sure that even makes sense anymore. But, you know, how does that carry over to restaurants and movie theaters and sporting events and concerts? It's going to be a very big challenge. You know, you're going to have occupancy rules at a restaurant. You're not going to be with a table on top of someone. You don't want to go to church or synagogue or the mosque and be right next to the person, right next to a person within 6 feet of you. There's going to be a lot of the heebie-jeebies until we get to a point where there's herd immunity and vaccine. I'm not going to go to a movie unless you can guarantee me I get this spot in a row and then someone's 5 seats down. I'm not going to go to a concert unless you can guarantee me someone's not going to be on top of me. And what fun would it be to go to a concert with 30 people? So we're going to have a lot of the squeamishness until we know that it's okay to go back to a big crowd or go to a restaurant or a bar where people are packed four deep. But there's going to be a lot of self-isolation from that until we know that it's safe to do that again. So it's going to be weird. I mean, we're social. Humans are social beings. Yeah. And, you know, the first instinct is to shake someone's hand when you meet them for the first time or give them a little kiss on the cheek. You know, in Europe, they do three kisses on the cheek. That's a triple no-no. But you can't elbow back. It's going to be strange, but that's going to become normal. And then say we get to vaccine and herd immunity, how do you go back to handshakes and hugs and get over that squeamishness factor? I don't know. That's a five-year look back. We'll talk again in 2025 and see where we are.
I hope we talk again sooner. And I know our time is coming to a close, but I would like to let readers and viewers and listeners know how they could, read your blog and watch your Facebook Lives. Can you tell them how they could experience?
So I post publicly on two different sites. One is medium.com, which is more of a free form, full length, attractively formatted way to post blogs and articles. So that's where I initially post my stream of consciousness that I do on Thursdays and Sundays. I also post it on Facebook if you're interested in reading that. And then every Tuesday night, I do what's called a Facebook Live, where I either solicit questions ahead of time or I use my daughter assistant to feed me questions during. And we spend an hour together. I try to answer as many questions as I can. I try to provide as much data as I can. You can ask funny questions. You can ask silly questions. No such thing as a stupid question. And I've gotten some relatively stupid questions. But I want to share the information. And the reality is, people have the same question that you have. They're just afraid to ask it. So it's a very laid back Tuesday night thing for an hour. You can wear whatever you want because I don't see you. You just see me. So you can wear your evening pajamas, get out of your day pajamas, and we can chat and you can just talk. I have a scroll on the side with questions and my lovely daughter will sort of curate those and feed those to me. And we just share a back and forth. So if that's helpful to you, please tune in. It's very low key. If it's not helpful and it's too much information, you know, it's okay to tune out the news. It's okay to tune out social media. It's okay to play a game of backgammon with your family or go out for a walk and just tune all this stuff out. But if you find it helpful, I'm out there.
Well, great. And I will make sure to provide a link for our viewers and podcast listeners with the description so they will have a way to connect with you. Thank you again, Dr. Harris Cohen, for all that you are doing to bring information and calm to our communities. And I do hope to speak with you again.
Before 2025, we'll chat again.
We will definitely chat again. I do look forward to hearing more from you. And you have a good day. And to all our listeners, this is Marion Callahan reporting from the Intelligencer, Gannett News. Have a good day, be safe, and be well. Thank you.
Thank you.